Welcome everybody to the week ahead. I'm Ben Ford, a G10 FX strategist here at MacroHive, and I'm joined by our regular Dominique. I'll lead on practically everything in regard to the US. Dom, how are you?
Well, thank you. Looking forward to the end of the year. And
Perfect.
yourself?
Oh, I'm great. I'm a big Christmas fanatic. I love it. You may be able to see my tree, oh, a bit blurred, but just
Very
behind me.
nice.
Love Christmas. But anyway, people were here to talk about the US, the week ahead, and what's going on to the end of the year. I think it's only right we kick things off with inflation. We've had a lot of data over the past week. We've obviously got a big release next week, so there's plenty to discuss. Broadly, I think it's probably fair to say the November CPI was in line with expectations, but when you look at some of the details, goods deflation stopped, supercore inflation accelerated a bit. I mean, if we can start with what happened in goods, is there something we need to worry about?
Yes, actually, and it's really interesting. And I would have thought it would happen sooner because it's not just this month, but you really see a pickup. I mean, basically the end in goods deflation. I mean, it's much smaller than it was 6 months ago. And when you look at import prices, you see that they are picking up. So obviously, goods prices are much more stable than income prices because importers absorb pardon, the changes in import prices through changes in margin. But when we came out of the pandemic, I thought end of globalization, climate change, excuse me, which is like when you think about it, it's like a negative supply shock, right? I mean, you get extreme weather events. People can't really w work outside when it's very hot. You need to push up the AC, which increases your cost, and so on and so forth. And the other thing is that people I haven't seen discussed enough. If you look at cheap prices, they've been increasing, and we had several decades of falling cheap prices. This was Moore's law. And then a few years before the pandemic, it stopped working. I mean, you starting an increase in chips. Now it could be because the AI chips are more expensive and so on and so forth. But even if you take that into account, the decades of very fast productivity growth are over. So I was naively thinking, goods prices are going to rise after the pandemic. And it didn't happen, but it looks like it's finally happening now. So to me, this is telling me that changes in economic variable take place over, I mean, are much slower than changes in markets. The other things that could be happening, of course, is China exporting deflation. Maybe this is less of a shock now that it used to be. But if I was in Chair Powell's shoes, I would be looking at this data on goods prices and be at the very least puzzled.
I was going to ask. I mean, we'll obviously get onto the Fed a bit later in this video, but have the Fed started, or have Fed speakers started, to pick up on this change in sort of the goods dynamic, i.e., that we can't really take goods deflation for granted anymore? Is that not quite hit the conversations yet?
Not yet. They are very focused on productivity growth. And to be fair, there is a pickup in productivity. And if it's a positive supply shock, right? So it means the economy can grow faster without an increase in inflation. So whether that pickup in productivity growth is sustainable is a key medium-term issue for them. So they are very much focused on that. On the good news, a bit less focused on the possible bad news on the good side, but at least publicly. But they have what 500 PhD econ looking at the data, so they must be looking at this with a fine comb.
And what about supercore? Because I guess the argument is, let's say goods deflation reverses, we have some goods inflation, but the services side of things starts to come down, and you basically have two contributions. They get you back to target, but it seems last month, super core inflation accelerated a bit. Is there sort of a story of persistence there, or is this just 1 month's data? I mean, what's your take?
So we don't know, and that's where the productivity story is super important because service, the main input for services is basically us human beings, right? So the main source of cost is wages. And if you have an increase in productivity, it helps keep the services inflation down because in terms of wages, we're clearly seeing stabilization around 4%. And the Fed back envelope calculation is that before the pandemic, productivity was about 1.5 percentage point. So 2% inflation plus 1.5% productivity growth, that made 3.5% wage growth consistent with the target. But if productivity is 2%, you can have 4% wage growth and the 2% inflation. So we're definitely seeing a flattening out of a super core and of core because this is the main component of core. And what happens next is a bit unclear. Powell told us that in his view, core and goods are where they were in the early 2000 when PCE was at target. So that's fine. And he thinks that shelter inflation is a laggard, but eventually will catch up. That's the plan. He's told us that for next year, he'll make sure that goods and super core remain in their current ranges, and that shelter continues to slow. We shall see.
Yeah, he's a let's just call him an optimist, perhaps.
That's his job.
Okay, so but obviously the we know the Fed, and as you always tell us, the Fed doesn't target CPI, targets PCE. Now this week we also had PPI. So for all of us market participants, CPI and some of PPI, put them together, you broadly get most of PCE. Now, for us non-US sort of experts, I think PPI this week was actually a bit confusing. You saw the final demand measure was actually stronger than expected. You saw the October number revised higher, but then the super core measure, if you want to call it that, was weaker than expected. I mean, the first things first, which number should we actually be looking at?
Core PCE because let me explain. I mean, CPI measures the cost of out-of-pocket expenses, while PCE measures cost more broadly across the economy. So, for instance, health insurance cost in the CPI, it's computed as a difference between the premiums that people pay and the reimbursement that insurers pay. So it has a very weird behavior. While in the PCE, the cost of health insurance is just the cost of the premium that you are paying. So these are two different concepts. Benefits that are indexed, like social security benefits, they are typically indexed. They are actually not typically. They are indexed to the CPI. But the Fed targets PCE, so the broader measure of cost, and PCE tends to be lower than CPI because it's also how the indices are computed. You have no substitution effect in the CPI, while in the PCE you allow for substitution effect. So when the price of something goes down, its weight goes up, its weight goes down in the PCE.
And where do you think CPI and PPI leaves us for PCE? I mean, if CPI was around 0.3% month for month, where's PCE going to print? Would it be slightly lower? I mean, do you have a view there?
Yeah, probably about 15 basis points. I think the market is a tad below 15, which means rounded up, it would be 0.2 versus a consensus of 0.3. But to be honest, Ben, these are really very little data quibble. Whether it's 0.2 or 0.3, won't change the Fed and won't really change the picture of what's going on in the US economy, which is a super strong economy with inflation stuck, basically.
So we could have a, say, 15 basis points PCE. I mean, where would that leave us versus, say, the SEP with the end of year projections? Does 15 basis points matters in a, would we still be close, or are we far away from what they expected?
So we would still be in the Fed comfort zone for core
Okay.
PCE. So what they have in this SEP is 2.6%, because when they published a CPE on September, we had two lower prints. So they brought the end 2024 core PCE forecast to 2.6 from previously 2.8%. I think, based on what Powell told us with his view of I am going to keep inflation within a range, they're probably okay with inflation in a 2.5 to 3% range, meaning they won't hike if inflation remains in that range. But I think that for next year, by contrast with December, where I think the decision to cut is because the Fed thinks it's still fairly restrictive, I think next year they will want to see actual slowdown in inflation to cut further.
So basically, he's gonna remain a bit optimistic, but perhaps a little bit less optimistic on these numbers. Is it?
Exactly. In the September SEP, we had four 2025 cuts. I think we're probably going to get two. In part because of the flattening out of the inflation trajectory. And also, I expect that a number of FOMC members are going to lift their estimate of the long-term Fed funds, which means that there will be less room to cut.
Now, but before we jump into the Fed, obviously the Fed's not driven just by inflation data. They have plenty of other data. They've got growth data, they've got unemployment data, or they have a fancy data points on offer to them. Now, many of our regular viewers will know your view on the next question I'm going to ask you, but it's a question we get every single week, no matter the client, no matter who they are. When claims are weaker or higher than expected, I think everyone's going to know your answer, but should we care?
Yes, we should, except that we need to look at the big picture. And the big picture is that if you look at continuing claims relative to the labor force, which is basically the rate of unemployment of people who are insured, it's actually been 1.1, 1.2% for like a couple of years. It's not going anywhere. All of the increase in unemployment that we've seen has come from uninsured unemployment. So definitely super important because it's a high frequency, higher frequency variable. But it's not showing that the labor market is weakening.
So basically no change there. And then in other sort of data that we have next week, we have retail sales and we have the, I think, the third release of GDP. It looks like both of them are expected to remain pretty strong. Like, I mean, I guess your take's going to be that, okay, look, this doesn't change the backdrop that US economy is basically above trend. But is there any signs that we're seeing some cracks in the US economy or any slowdown, or is this just going to keep you pretty happy that the US economy is doing pretty well?
So I keep expecting the crack, and the crack never shows up. I think, what I think we have is a slowdown in employment, perhaps not as pronounced as I was expecting. That is coming, but not yet. But employment growth is slowing down, but GDP growth is actually accelerating or remaining well above trend. And so that's basically telling you that GDP per capita is accelerating, which is a story about productivity. People produce more, they get paid more, so they can consume more. And that story, based on the data, seems pretty much intact.
I mean, there's not a lot you can do. If the data wants to remain strong, the data's going to remain strong. And now I feel like I've kept this hidden for far too long. The Fed, we've somehow not talked about it. We're 10, 15 minutes in. Fed's coming next week. Let's get this out of the way. What's your call? Is it 25 basis point cuts, 50, or a pause?
No, 25. I've been saying 25 since the September FOMC, so since the November, well, since September, yeah. So no change in the call, and it's driven by much more by the still high degree of restrictiveness of Fed policy than by progress on disinflation.
Now, it's probably fair to say that everyone's sort of now hunkered around this 25 basis point cut expectation. Even if they weren't expecting it a month or two ago, they probably expect it now, which means for markets at least, the cut is probably less significant than it typically would be. Markets have priced it in, they expect it. If they didn't do it, that's the shock. So probably, well, it's telling you that what is actually more important is probably the SEP, the presser, the statement. So we should, well, let's kick off with the SEP, because I guess that'll probably help direct the statement and help Powell in his presser. Now, are you expecting any sort of big changes in the SEP, anything in the Fed funds rate, the unemployment, the inflation dots? Is there anything you're looking out for in particular, or?
Sure. I mean, the thing about the SCP is that in a way it forces the Fed to be optimistic because the Fed cannot show a SCP that would show inflation getting out of control, God forbid, or a hard landing, right? Because it would be blasted for not adjusting policy settings to ensure that soft landing. So the problem with the SCP is that it forces the Fed to show more foresight and more control over inflation than it really has. But you know, it is what it is. So basically, I think they will have to show that we go back to 2% in 2026, as in the previous SCP. And then they will have to lift the Fed funds rate trajectory to reflect the fact that inflation has recently been higher. So you have a higher starting point for inflation. You want to end up in the same destination. You just have to ease less. And that's why I
So,
think they'll only
I
show.
was going to ask, so what do you think the dots are going to show for cuts next year?
Just two
Just
instead of four. Yeah.
and to give some context to that, is that in consensus? Are most people expecting two? Are they expecting three? Are they expecting no change? I mean, just to give some clarity around this, is two sort of a hawkish
So,
call?
I do not pay too much attention to what my friends and competitors think. I think there is a clear, everybody agrees that it will be fewer than four because FOMC members have been saying that they will cut more slowly. There's been some talk of the time for a pause is approaching, and so on and so forth. So I think the people are likely to be split between two and three cuts. And the reason I put two is because I think that with the faster GDP growth, the FOMC members are going to infer that R star has gone up, so they are going to lift their estimate of the long-term Fed funds, which means there will be less room to cut on the way back to that magical 2% inflation target.
Great. So another conversation about R star. It feels like every time R star comes up, everyone agrees that it's useful, but then no one agrees on how to get to the correct R star or what the actual number is. But then going on to, I guess, actually converging onto the topic of R star, how many cuts do you see for 2026? Will markets care as much about 2026, or is that just okay, like they've moved 2025, so they have to move 2026?
So for 2026, I I see three cuts, but I don't think the market will care that much about that.
Okay, that's fair enough. So basically, the main message here is, okay, look, they're going to have to shift their PCE focus up a touch, and in reality, that's going to be reflected in two cuts in the SEP for 2025, and then okay, look, 2026 is going to have to follow as well.
Yeah, basically they have to show the same trajectory that they are, excuse me, strong believers in the 2% target. So they have to get back to 2% by 2026. And since their starting point, which is the latest PCE data now, is higher than it used to be, they have to show that they will cut less.
Now, I get it. Obviously, the next part of this is the statement, and then we can get onto the presser. Are you expecting much of a change in the statement from the Fed?
No, the Fed is very minimalist when it comes to the statement. Maybe something about, taking note of the flatter inflation trajectory, but I'm not expecting a descent either, based on my forecast of only two cuts in 2025. I don't see someone like Bauman, for instance, dissenting again.
And I guess the presser, the bit everyone waits for, once we've seen the SEP, once we've seen the statement, everyone sits there waiting the half an hour for the presser. Is there any sort of key themes you expect to see from Powell in the presser?
I think he's going to repeat his story about, we are almost there, it's just housing inflation. And don't worry, I will make sure that inflation doesn't get out of its range. He might talk about productivity. And to be fair to him, if we have this productivity surge that's ongoing, there's no reason to try to kill growth. I mean, you as a policymaker, you should let it play out as much as you possibly can. So he might say, that it's good that the US economy is so strong, as long as inflation remain on the path back to 2%, which it is. So he might make some positive noises about growth, basically.
Okay, so I mean, just to wrap up on the Fed then. So you think 25 basis point cuts. You think SEP is basically going to show two cuts for 2025. Statement will broadly be unchanged, and Powell's basically going to try remain optimistic on the inflation outlook. And just to quickly get some context, they could show two cuts in 2025. How many do you think they actually deliver?
I actually don't think they will be able to deliver the cuts because in 20, given where inflation is and that inflation is stuck, around 2 3/4% for core PC, they really need to see the inflation come down before they can cut. And I actually think that the labor market is going to get tighter next year, in part because we will have a big decline in immigrants, even without Trump kicking out 11 million, which is not going to happen. It's not. I mean, it's so insane that, I mean, he will expel a few people who've had trouble with the law, but I mean, you expel 11 million, you have like the mother of a stagflation because you basically cut the economy productive capacity. So even assuming that this does not happen, the fact that the Biden administration has closed the border is showing up with much fewer migrants coming to the US. And of course, when Trump takes over next year, he will shut down the border much more tightly than Biden has. So countries that have humanitarian parole, for instance, will lose them. And so that will make for a tighter labor market, stronger wage growth. And that, in my view, is going to keep inflation where it is. And I'm not even mentioning the risk about goods inflation that we were talking about earlier.
Well, I mean, it's one hell of a call, but knowing you, Domi, I'll probably end up right now. I feel like you've done my job for me a bit. You've led us to talk about Trump. Now it feels like it's been a bit quiet on the Trump front for a tiny bit, but you've put out a note quickly or going through his cabinet selections. So it's probably worth just going through that. Are there any key points in his cabinet selections? Is there anything people might have missed, or you think they're just there's okay, this is a real big point. This stands out and people should know about it.
Yeah, I think that for market performance next year, one thing which is going to be absolutely key is whether the administration turns out to favor, the capitalists. So like policies that lift profit income share, because there is some very, very serious academic research showing that the strong equity market performance we've had for the past few decades reflect is directly linked to the increase in the income share of profits, which is very intuitive. But you have very highly respectable academics publishing in very prestigious journal and showing a strong empirical relationship between these two things. So the thing with Trump is that he's making pro-business, so pro-profit noises, and also populist noises. Like I was just putting on chat a comment about so by the way, now we all have to go to Truth Social, not Twitter. Truth Social is where Trump truth. You don't say tweets, you say truth. But he was talking about his meeting with a longshoreman. So these are the people who bring stuff in the US sea ports. And they are very famous because they are the only non-college graduates who have been able to maintain high wages. I mean, as a longshoreman, you get paid 200, 250K a year. If you can get in, you can imagine that the competition is very strong. But it's a very, very unionized sector, and they've been trying to negotiate their wage agreement. So they just went to see Trump, and Trump put out a truth, which is really interesting. He said companies that are importing stuff to the US have made enormous profit, and instead of investing in new equipment, they should pay the longshoremen more money. So it's interesting because you see the populist strand there. And also, the bottom line is I think Trump won, the Republicans won, largely because of the decline in real incomes during the pandemic. And many low-income households have not fully recovered. So there is this incentive to increase the share of wages in GDP. But unless you can maintain this high GDP growth, you can't do that without decreasing the share of profit. And that's bad for the market, right? We won't get the same strong earnings report. And that issue of populism versus pro-market policy, I think it's still unresolved.
Now, I said we didn't actually get, well, I said it was actually kind of a quiet week for Trump in the end, but
And but if I could just add,
oh,
going
okay,
back to
go for it.
my note on the appointees, so there are two things that are striking about the appointees. First of all, only half of them have policy experience, which goes with Trump being a disruptor, fair enough. I mean, if he picks a cabinet from the establishment is not going to disrupt much. And the second thing is you see this I wouldn't call it conflict, but this trade-off between pro-market policy and populism. So on the pro-market side, you have Scott Bessent's appointment, you have the SEC appointment, you have Trump saying that he won't try to get rid of Powell. So all good noises from a market perspective. But then, he has appointed a Secretary of Labor who happens to be a pro-labor Republican lawyer. Yeah, it sounds strange, but it exists. He found one. And that's who he appointed. And he's also appointed a strong anti-monopoly person at, in the division of the Department of Justice that does antitrust policies. So right now he's doing both. He gives signs that he's both supporting higher income and a stronger market, but at some point he may have to choose.
I was going
And
to say, can they survive together over the long term? Sure, I'm over a few months, a couple quarters, I'm sure they can smile at each other in the corridors. But over an entire Trump presidency, I mean, will that work out, having sort of populism and pro markets in the same cabinet?
it depends on the growth rate. I think their plan is that they will deregulate, they will cut taxes, so the size of the economic pie will be bigger, and they can do a bit of both. It's possible. I mean, some of the policies they are looking at, so the 11 million people to be expelled will, I mean, this is insane. So hopefully they won't do that. They could also damage growth with the tariffs, depending on how they implement, like the invitation to Xi Jinping to attend inauguration was very interesting because it suggests that Trump wants to make a deal. So that's good for the market. But he's fairly mercurial. So really the proof of the pudding is going to be in the eating, as you Brits say. But this is something I'm watching very closely.
Yeah, I kind of actually wanted to lead on to the whole Xi Jinping invite. I mean, the sort of experience we've had with Trump so far, and when I mean experience so far, I mean just this sort of transition period, so just 2024, we've had what we did with Mexico and Canada, and while it was, I guess, sort of immediate and sort of harsh, he quickly came to negotiations. And then obviously, going into the election, everyone sort of thought, okay, look, if Trump wins, China's in big trouble. But now it looks that Trump's at least trying to make friends or trying to make smart business decisions with China. Do you think this is a reflection of things going forward? Or do you think this is actually quite similar to 2016, 17, when Trump was trying to be friends with China back then, but then quickly he flipped a switch and obviously ended up tariffing China quite a lot? I mean, what's your take? Should we believe in that Trump's actually not going to tariff anybody and he's just going to be a businessman, or is this all just too good to be true so far?
So he will probably try to make deals. He loves those. And rather than tariff, get the Chinese to commit to buying more US goods. I suspect something similar could be going on with Europe. He's a businessman and he really wants to do well by the business. There's no question about that. So his preference will be to make deals rather than take an aggressive stance. But again, is he going to keep with this strategy? Will other countries play ball? I mean, China is certainly, if Trump starts threatening China, they are not going to rush to send someone to have dinner with him at Mar-a-Lago. They will take it very badly. And so it's interesting that he threatened Mexico and Canada, but not China, that China instead gets a VIP treatment, which suggests he wants to be more deal focused, perhaps less aggressive than in his first term, which is very positive for growth, by the way.
And I mean, if China somehow come out of this without increased tariffs, I know we've already had that small announcement from Trump on Truth Social. It almost sounds like a gray swan. Now this links perfectly into what Macro Hive, I guess, have become semi-famous for in our world is the gray swans. Now you've written three gray swans this year. One on Trump and Powell becoming friends, one on the illegal immigrants, and then one on tariffs. I mean, I just wanted to go through for them. I encourage everyone to read them, not just Dominique's. You'll see others coming out through your email periodically, or you can go onto the website and read them. But Dom, I thought it was a great opportunity to go through one of them. Is there Is there any in particular you call a favorite? I know it's a bit hard to call one of them a favorite. It's almost like calling one of your kids your favorite. A hard thing to do. But is there a Grace one you like or you want to talk about?
Sure, I mean the one between the Fed and Trump becoming best friend. I mean, the bottom line is for all the discourse, electioneering, and talk, and so on and so forth. It's all about economic realities, right? And who has the power, the printing power, the printing press power? It's the Fed. And so I don't want to give away too much. I'll just say that the Grace one is about a surprise present from Secretary Bessent to Chair Powell, in recognition of the role the Fed played. So I imagine that there is a huge volatility on fixed income market, and the Fed has to bring its balance sheet to calm market. And so suddenly White House and Fed, it's like kumbaya, everybody is good friends, and things improve, and so on and so forth. I guess I just want to say that the Fed is not actually the enemy of the administration, because the Fed is fairly dovish. They've shown they don't want to kill growth if there is a positive productivity shock. Also, on the part of the administration, they were elected because of high inflation. If they let inflation get out of control, they are going to lose the next election. So perhaps there isn't as much of a conflict as people think. Anyway, I tried to be funny, whatever that means. So I hope people will read.
No, I love the pieces. Now, just to reiterate, I mean, if you want to read them, they're on our website, or if you're subscribed, you can and you will see them come through your email periodically. I guess we'll call that a wrap, Dom. Thank you everybody for watching. I believe this is the last one before the holiday, so if it is, happy holidays, everyone. And we'll see
Happy
you in the new
holidays.
year. Thanks, Dom.